From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, new developments out of Ukraine about their crisis. The IRC says it's a critical time in South Sudan. We'll look at militant kidnappings, plus the 75th anniversary of the famed jazz record label Blue Note. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Ukraine has restored the military draft. Its acting president, Alexander Turchynov, signed a conscription decree on Thursday on improving the country's defense capabilities. The move comes a day after Mr. Turchynov said that his government was helpless to quell the growing pro-Russian separatist movement in two eastern regions and could not control its own troops. On Thursday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow thinks a dialogue could be established between Ukraine's government and its opponents. Meantime, Ukrainian officials are accusing separatists in eastern Ukraine of using hostages as human shields to prevent the military from taking action against them. But some observers in Kiev disagree. They say the hostages, including some observers with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, are being held to swap for detained pro-Russian activists. VOA's Brian Patton has more from Kiev.
In the southeast Ukrainian city of Slovansk, pro-Russian militants have detained a number of OSCE observers, journalists, and local officials. Ukrainian authorities say they have been taken hostage to deter the military from attacking. But Ukrainian political analyst Sergei Slobodchuk disagrees.
I don't think that they had a far-reaching plan to use them as human shields. They did not take enough hostages to protect them if the military takes action.
Slobodchuk says the separatists do not fear retaliation from the military or police in the region because neither group is strong enough, nor do these security forces want to get involved in what they see as a political power struggle. Igor Damon, the police spokesman for the city of Donetsk, says authorities are using dialogue rather than force to deal with the protesters who have taken over government buildings.
We are negotiating with them, and the main goal for us is to prevent bloodshed. Everybody should understand that if either side takes up arms, this can grow into a war against brothers.
Separatists in Slovansk say they want to exchange their prisoners for pro-Russian activists who were arrested in Kiev. Bogdan Ovcharuk with the human rights group Amnesty International says his organization is calling for a full investigation into these detentions.
And from the reports for what we've seen, that these separatist groups are using people as a bargaining chip is appalling, it's unlawful, and this should be tackled urgently.
Amnesty International says both pro-Kiev and pro-Russian groups have been involved in illegally detaining people, and there seems to be no national authority to be able to stop either side. Brian Patton, VOA News, Kiev.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
An apparent car bomb killed at least 9 people Thursday on the outskirts of the Nigerian capital, Abuja. This man and his brother were at the site where the bomb went off.
I fell down. It's last time. So I just fell down. And my brother that was standing with me, they said I fell down on the head.
Thursday's blast was near the site of an April 14th bombing at a bus station that killed at least 75 people. The extremist group Boko Haram claimed responsibility for the April blast and promised more attacks. Nigeria is planning to host the World Economic Forum on Africa next week, and President Goodluck Jonathan has promised extraordinary security measures for that meeting. Witnesses are saying that Ethiopian police, have killed at least 17 protesters, happened during demonstrations in Ethiopia's Oromia region against plans to annex territory to expand the capital, Addis Ababa. Residents tell VOA that an elite government security force opened fire on protesters at three university campuses. Ethiopian officials say the master plan for expansion was publicized long ago and would bring city services to remote areas. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is warning of the risk of genocide in South Sudan if 4 months of deadly fighting there is not stopped. VOA Scott Stearns reporting now from Ethiopia, where Mr. Kerry on Thursday discussed the violence with regional foreign ministers and African Union officials.
Secretary Kerry says those responsible for what he calls unspeakable violence in South Sudan must be brought to justice to prevent the conflict from deteriorating further.
There are very disturbing leading indicators of the kind of ethnic, tribal, targeted, nationalistic killings taking place that raise serious questions. And were they to continue in the way that they've been going, could really present a very serious challenge to the international community with respect to the question of genocide.
Kerry says he's working with regional leaders to avoid that by moving to put people on the ground who can begin to make a difference, separating people and providing security. He met here in Addis Ababa with foreign ministers from Ethiopia, Kenya, and Uganda, who he says all agree on the need for African troops under a United Nations mandate. He also pushed them to join U.S. moves toward a travel ban and assets freeze on those responsible for the violence, but said Washington is absolutely prepared to move on its own.
We may well move on our own, but each of the foreign ministers today accepted the responsibility for also doing sanctions.
Kerry says some of the violence is the responsibility of individual generals with their own agenda, but the place to start is the place where it started, and that's with South Sudan's President Salva Kiir and his former Vice President Riek Machar. The most serious fighting began in late December, soon after the Kiir government accused Machar of trying to seize power. While a senior State Department official says Washington does not buy into the narrative of a coup attempt, Kerry says there is a clear distinction between the men, whose personal anger is fueling this violence.
The current president of South Sudan is the elected constitutional president of a country. And Mr. Machar is a rebel who is trying to unconstitutionally take power by force. And there is a clear distinction. There is no equivalency between the two.
Kerry says Machar needs to think clearly about that, particularly in the wake of allegations that ethnic Nuer rebels killed hundreds of civilians in the town of Bentiu last month. A UN report says the rebels separated individuals of certain nationalities and ethnic groups and escorted them to safety while the others were killed. A rebel spokesman has denied that allegation. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The International Rescue Committee says it's not too late to prevent South Sudan from falling into a prolonged conflict. However, the humanitarian group says it will require a lot of international pressure and greater support for the UN presence. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
IRC Country Director Wendy Teuber says just 2.5 years ago, South Sudan was a place of hope. Action is needed now, she says, to preserve the gains made since South Sudan gained its independence. She calls it an opportunity, despite the many horror stories being reported. That said, Teuber warns conditions of late have deteriorated.
With the increased fighting, further displacement, and the onset of the rainy season, it's sort of a perfect storm, if you will, of complete calamity on the horizon if we don't act now. So it's a very important moment to do as much as we can.
Speaking from the capital, Juba, Teuber says the many years of U.S. support have created a lot of goodwill in South Sudan and give the Obama administration leverage. She's encouraged by the scheduled visit of Secretary of State John Kerry.
We're hoping that he can talk to all sides and encourage them to really push forward on some kind of peace agreement. I mean, we don't want to be naive in thinking that the fighting will stop overnight, but certainly there's things we can ask for. The 30-day period of tranquility, it would be wonderful if parties could at least agree to a ceasefire for the month of May, during which time people would be free to move around, plant, reunite with their families.
Teuber says Kerry could lend some renewed energy to the peace process.
The talks in Ethiopia have not been going very well, but we hope that high-level engagement of someone at John Kerry's level could give a jump start to renewed negotiations and some fresh inputs, ideas.
The IRC country director says one of the biggest problems facing South Sudan is food insecurity.
We do have 3.7 million people at immediate risk of extreme hunger. And, of course, the reports have mentioned that if planting season is missed completely and displacement continues over the coming months, we could see 7 million people at risk by the end of the year or early next year, as crops may fail and people would have nothing to eat. And, of course, over time that can develop into extreme starvation.
She says now is the time to pre-position emergency food stocks and distribute farming tools, seeds, and fishing nets.
A lot of people are displaced along the Nile River, which is teeming with fish. So there's a lot that could still be done in the next month or two before the heavy, heavy rains come.
Toiber recently described South Sudan as a place where no one feels safe.
What's been especially upsetting about the fighting of the last few weeks is that places people would normally seek refuge in any time of conflict anywhere in the world, you might think of running to a hospital or a church or a mosque. And in this particular conflict, a lot of people have sought refuge inside the UN bases. All of these have been attacked in the last 2 weeks, you could say.
The International Rescue Committee has not been immune to the violence. Two IRC health workers were shot dead during the recent attack on the UN compound in Bor. Besides health care, the IRC is also providing fresh drinking water and sanitation, as well as prevention and response programs for gender-based violence.
Women and girls are at particular risk in any conflict, as they may be running their own households if their husbands and brothers have gone off to join the fighting.
The International Rescue Committee says the May 20th Donors Conference on South Sudan in Oslo could be critical to avoiding a catastrophe. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Hundreds of women and girls were abducted last month in Nigeria, allegedly by Boko Haram. The government there has been trying to grapple with the activists of the Islamist terrorist group. In light of the story, VOA's Susan Yaki spoke with Max Abrams of Northeastern University, as well as the Council on Foreign Relations, who has just finished a study of militant kidnappings. She asked him, under what conditions are hostage takers more likely to achieve their demands?
Yes, this is a question that I focus on extensively in my research. Generally, I look at which tactics are best from the vantage of the perpetrators. And by perpetrators, I usually mean militant groups. So in the case of hostage taking, militant groups tend to take the hostages in order to achieve what's sometimes called redemptive demands. The nature of their demands is often pertains to the building up of their organization. So they may ask for financial demands. Those are the most common. They may ask for the release of prisoners held by the government. They may ask for safe passage into another location, into another country. In the case of Boko Haram, it's not entirely clear why they took the hostages, but presumably to help their organization in a similar way. And I've just completed a statistical study with my co-author, Matthew Gottfried, over at UCLA, where we look at the determinants of hostage-taking success. That is, the likelihood that the hostage-takers will achieve at least one of their demands for the organization. And we actually have good news. What we find is that the better the hostage takers treat the hostages, the more likely the government is to subsequently bargain with the hostage takers. In particular, we look at the effects of harming the hostages versus releasing them unharmed. And what we find is that governments are significantly and substantially less likely to trade with the hostage takers after they've physically harmed one of the hostages. And so the implications of the study are really clear for Boko Haram, and that is that Boko Haram is more likely to achieve its demands if it releases unscathed the 273 women in their custody.
Does the treatment of the hostages also contribute to the government's decision whether or not to invade, to attack, and violently end the hostage situation?
In our study, we didn't test that directly. But in other studies of mine, yes, what I have found is that when militant groups attack non-combatants, and this would clearly be a case of that, because the girls were, you know, going to school, and certainly once they were taken as hostages, you know, they weren't in a position to resist. And what I find is that when civilians are harmed by non-state actors, particularly militant groups, governments tend to go on the offensive. They tend to dig in their political heels, and they tend to try to violently oppose the perpetrators. And so for that reason as well, I would strongly urge Boko Haram to release the hostages. They're much unharmed. Doing so would increase the odds that they would achieve their demands and lower the odds that the government will, you know, violently oppose the perpetrators.
Max Abrams, a professor at Northeastern University and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was speaking with my colleague, Susan Yockey. Also in the news, Syrian opposition activists say government aircraft struck a busy market in the rebel-controlled district of Aleppo, killing at least 33 people. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said Thursday's attack occurred in the Hilak area. The attack comes a day after a strike on an Aleppo school that left 18 dead, many of them children. Aleppo's been divided between government forces and rebels, with forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad carrying out frequent airstrikes and dropping barrel bombs in rebel-held areas. Iraqi election officials are counting ballots after the country's first general election since U.S. troops withdrew in 2011. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki said the high level of participation was a slap in the face to terrorism and those who wanted to disrupt the election. He also expressed confidence that his party would take the lead and call on others to join him in forming a ruling coalition. Final results from the election are not expected for at least 2 weeks. Election officials say about 60% of the country's 22 million eligible voters took part in Wednesday's vote.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's premier newsmaker interview program. If you have ideas for guests or topics, or want to comment on one of our programs, please write to us at Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the internet, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is pcusa@voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
And now a little something from the VOA Music Department. This year marks an important anniversary for jazz, one that on a number of occasions looked like it would never arrive. Richard Paul reports now on the 75th birthday of the legendary Blue Note record label.
Nothing that becomes legendary starts out that way. In 1939, Blue Note Records was the grain of an idea by Alfred Lion and Frank Wolfe, two Germans who fell in love with music like this by boogie-woogie piano player Albert Ammons. They first heard jazz improvisation as young men in Germany during the early years of the Nazi regime. Richard Havers is writing a book about Blue Note called Uncompromising Expressions. He says that to the Nazis,
jazz was everything that they hated. It was freedom of expression. It was not regimented. It didn't go to a militaristic beat.
Lion and Wolf pursued their love of jazz and freedom by leaving Germany for the United States. Shortly after arriving and hearing Ammons and another boogie-woogie piano player, Mead Lux Lewis, they scratched together some money, put Ammons in a studio, and Blue Note Records was born. The label was swimming against the tide by promoting this kind of music. Dan Ouellette has written a book about Blue Note called Playing by Ear.
Back then, it was all about dancing.
And people were not dancing to boogie-woogie piano. Ouellette says Alfred Lion's approach was more like a museum curator than a record producer.
He wanted to document this music. His whole philosophy is that jazz is an art form.
Treating artists as artists and swimming against the tide became hallmarks of Blue Note jazz, an approach that finally paid off in the 1940s when jazz shifted away from the dance music of the big band era and toward a new form that came to be called bebop. According to Richard Havers,
Lion quickly realized that jazz was moving in a different direction, and the first of the new wave of artists that he recorded was Thelonious Monk, who he absolutely adored.
Thelonious Monk was famous for playing the wrong notes. Many people thought it was just rubbish.
While most of the music business didn't understand artists like Monk, Richard Havers says this was another example of Blue Note treating artists like artists.
Alfred Lion gave his artists the freedom to do what they wanted to do. They felt they were artists. They were not money machines.
Blue Note was well respected and had some financial success, but by the 1960s, Dan Ouellette says things were not looking good for Blue Note or jazz.
Rock music and the beginnings of funk were coming around, and people are running away in droves because of rock music.
In 1967, Alfred Lion sold Blue Note to another record company. They drove it into the ground. In a rush to make money quickly, they stopped paying for rehearsal time and otherwise alienated the label's biggest stars, many of whom left to go to other record companies. The label got a reprieve in 1981 and had another long run of artistic success, but by the early 2000s, according to the current head of Blue Note, producer Don Was,
there was a lot of talk about closing the label down, making it a website that sold catalog and blue t-shirts.
Instead, the label decided to revive itself again. Mainly by turning back to a way of working that would make Alfred Lion proud. According to current Blue Note artist Jason Moran, today, as they did in the past,
people just went in and they make their music. You follow the intuition of the artist and the artist that they work with, and you come together to make a recording.
This return to the old ways is paying off, according to Dan Ouellette.
The music that you're hearing today with some young artists like Robert Glasper and Jason Moran, the music is evolving. It's not staying put. It's not dying.
For VOA News, I'm Richard Paul.
Isn't it? Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. As always, you can find us on the internet anytime at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer Zarat Abuzaid, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
This is Today in History. On May 2nd, 1670, the Hudson Bay Company was chartered to oversee trade throughout much of British-controlled territory in North America. The company's traders and trappers were responsible for much of the early exploration on the North American continent. On this day in 1860, Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism, was born in Budapest. Herzl championed the dream of a permanent home for the Jewish people. He died in 1904, 45 years before his dream was realized. On this day in 1933, a Scottish newspaper, the Inverness Courier, reported the account of a local couple that claimed to have seen an enormous animal rolling and plunging in the waters of Loch Ness. The newspaper's editor took the liberty of calling the beast a monster, and when the story was picked up by the London newspapers, the modern legend of the Loch Ness Monster was born. In 1994, South African President F.W. de Klerk conceded victory to Nelson Mandela and his African National Congress in their overwhelming victory in the country's first all-race election. Mandela was inaugurated May 10th as the head of a national unity government. American singer Leslie Gore was born on this day in 1946. One of the most popular pop singers of the 1960s, Gore's first hit was recorded at the tender age of 16. It's my party and I'll cry if I want to, cry if I want to, cry if I want to.
You would cry too if it happened to you.
The record's producer was Quincy Jones. Leslie's brother, Michael Gore, is an Oscar-winning composer. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Why was he holding her hand when he's supposed to be mine? It's my
part. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
With the appointment of a new prime minister, Madagascar has taken an important step toward returning to democracy after 5 years of political and economic instability. Roger Colo, a medical doctor uninvolved in the island nation's recent tumultuous politics, was named to the post April 11th by President Ari Rajoelina-Rimampian. The appointment follows President Rajoelina-Rimampian's election in December, the first presidential poll since a coup toppled former President Marc Ravalomanana in 2009 and disrupted the nation's relations with many in the international community. The United States welcomes the formation of a new government, and we look forward to working with it to promote a prosperous, democratic, and healthy future for all Malagasy. Prime Minister Colo's appointment and that of a new slate of cabinet ministers presents an opportunity to break with the past and begin to rehabilitate the economy, strengthen the country's democratic institutions and rule of law, protect Madagascar's unique biodiversity, and restore respect for human rights. We remain one of Madagascar's largest partners, providing over $55 million last year for food security and health programs.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.